KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Senate Republicans conceded yesterday that they lacked the votes to pass the Graham-Cassidy bill, which would repeal key parts of the Affordable Care Act. But experts from both sides of the aisle still say the health care law has room for improvement. Ezekiel Emanuel, a bioethicist, oncologist, and chief architect of Obamacare, joins us to talk about the changes he'd like to see to make health care more affordable and accessible to Americans. And he'll talk about his book, Prescription for the Future, the 12 Transformational Practices of Highly Effective Medical Organizations. That's next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. After Maine Senator Susan Collins came out firmly against the Graham-Cassidy bill, the GOP's latest plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, Senate Republicans acknowledged yesterday the chances of its passage are nearly impossible. But experts and advocates across the political spectrum, including the chief architect of the Affordable Care Act itself, think the law can be improved. In his new book, Prescription for the Future, bioethicist and oncologist Ezekiel Emanuel urges politicians and the healthcare industry to focus on reducing costs and improving patient care. We'll talk to Emanuel, who is now Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at University of Pennsylvania, about what makes for an effective medical organization. And we'll find out about his multiple meetings with President Trump. But first, we want to get the latest on the Graham-Cassidy bill and Republican efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act from Anna Edney. And she's a health policy reporter with Bloomberg. Welcome, Anna Edney.
Thank you.
Let me say your name right. Anna Edney. Okay, Mitch McConnell did not say that he's planning on bringing Graham-Cassidy to the floor. Are Republicans planning to move on this, or is another proposal expected?
They're meeting right now as we're talking here. They're having their regular Tuesday lunches, which are divided by party. So the Republicans going into the lunch have said they're going to talk about whether they actually want to hold a vote on Graham-Cassidy, even though, you know, they've had enough senators come out against it that they wouldn't actually be able to pass it.
And what about repeal effort? Will it come up against the filibuster rule?
Certainly, they, you know, only have until the end of Friday to be able to pass something under these rules that allow them to do so with a simple majority. So they would just need 50 votes. And Republicans have a 52-vote majority, but they haven't been able to get enough Republicans to support their latest repeal efforts. You know, we've seen lately in this debate, there's always a chance that something, some way, somehow could come back up, but it doesn't look like Graham-Cassidy will be the way forward.
Well, Susan Collins was kind of the capstone of the unlikelihood of this getting through, Maine senator, and Senator McCain from Arizona has been in opposition. But when we heard President Trump talking about the likelihood of Kentucky Senator
Rand Paul.
Zeke gave me the name here. Rand Paul actually being possibly turned around on this?
That was the one senator that has come out and said no and voiced a lot of opposition to this bill, the Graham-Cassidy measure, and tweeted a lot about how he doesn't like it. He thinks it's actually too light on Obamacare, that it doesn't go far enough to repeal the law. You know, he made some of those comments previously, and that was when the Senate was voting on a different repeal bill back in July, yet he still supported the measure in the end. So there was some thought that possibly he could flip and vote yes for this if it was to come to the floor.
So where's this going? Where do you see this going? What do you think?
Well, if they bring it up for a vote, it's an interesting tactic. Maybe they're thinking they can pressure someone like Rand Paul to vote yes for it if it's actually, you know, comes down to it. But they have had a lot of senators who haven't even said how they would vote yet. We know Lisa Murkowski from Alaska was, you know, had some major concerns with it. She actually hasn't said, you know, whether she would support it or not. And there were other senators that I heard yesterday in the Senate Finance Committee hearing on Graham-Cassidy Senator Portman being one of them, who were Republicans that said, you know, actually, I'm undecided on this. I don't know how I would vote. So that could be a risky measure if they decide to actually hold the vote on this. There is another stabilization package that there were talks of that currently it's frozen right now, but that was the bipartisan effort between Senators Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander that was just trying to do sort of a quick fix so that the Obamacare markets could have some certainty maybe for a year or two.
And Adney, much appreciate your updating us on this, and thank you.
Thank you.
And Adney, again, is health policy reporter with Bloomberg. And welcome, Dr. Emanuel. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be back at KQED.
I'm thinking I want to talk to you eventually about your article in The Atlantic. It stirred up all kinds of controversy about how one should think about giving it up at 75 or something along those lines. I was thinking about that as I struggled with Rand Paul somehow. You know, where was Rand Paul's name in my consciousness where it's supposed to be? But as the brain shrinks and as you get older, those things do happen. I want to talk to you about healthcare, though, and get right into it with you. It's likely to fail this latest, but in some ways, this is the worst yet. I mean, all that mean stuff that President Trump was talking about earlier on, these would be huge cuts to the poor, it would have raised costs for people having to buy more insurance. I mean, from most perspective, particularly from one of the architects of Obamacare, I imagine couldn't be worse.
I think every health policy expert would agree that this bill is worse on almost every measure compared to all the previous efforts. In particular, not only does it take the Medicaid expansion money and the subsidies for the exchanges and put them together into a block grant and reduce that, it actually, after 2026, substantially reduces traditional Medicaid to try to strangle it also. So, in fact, people are talking about, well, there are certain states that will win, and they're the states that haven't expanded, like Texas and Florida, and other states like California and New York would lose because money would be taken away. But the truth be told, after 2026, every state would be devastated. We're talking about $1 trillion in cuts. States can't make that kind of money up. So I think the real fact is this is actually a devastating bill.
And excuse me, nothing about pre-existing conditions in this bill either, is there?
Well, there is this thing that states can waive the they can waive any regulation.
It's up to the state.
In the ACA. All they have to show on the pre-existing condition exclusion is that they have a plan and that it's affordable. It's adequate and affordable. Well, the problem is we already heard from Senator Cassidy. He defined affordable as people should be able to afford it. Well, that circular reasoning is not very helpful. And he said, well, you know, if an insurance product is $39,000, that's not affordable. But there is a standard of affordability in the ACA. It's if the health insurance premium to you is over 9.5% of the household income, it's unaffordable. At that rate, there will be a lot of people where it's unaffordable. But I don't think that's a standard that Senator Cassidy is going to use. And one of the consequences of that is that if states go that route, a lot of people with pre-existing conditions either will not be able to be insured or will not get affordable insurance. What they do is basically fragment the pool. So they take healthy people and put them in one pool to give them low rates. They take sicker people, put them in a very expensive pool. That actually is a prescription for a very inefficient market. What you want is a big, big pool. That's how come big companies can get cheaper health care.
That's what the ACA was supposed to provide somehow, in fact.
Right. And in places like California, where you have more than 1 million people in the exchange, you actually have succeeded. I mean, your exchange is, I would say, probably among the best performing in the country. You've done almost everything right, and it's a very good model for how exchanges can work, and you don't have uncovered counties. You have had competition that's driven the premiums down, and most of the problems that, you know, really affect the California exchange come from Washington and the fact that things haven't improved in Washington. They don't come from the management of the exchange. I think Covered California has shown that you can actually run a pretty good exchange. Now, one of the things we should be clear is not everyone's going to be a winner in that situation. There are some people that are going to pay more, and we should be clear who those people are. They're going to be people who are young and healthy and have for a long time gotten very favorable rates because you know, they're healthy and insurance companies will give them low rates. And largely people who are well off, who in general are also in better health. And, you know, any big policy for 320 million Americans is going to have some winners and losers, and we should not pretend everyone's going to be a winner. And but on balance, it's helped millions and millions of people. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, I know that lots of people find it hard to believe, but healthcare costs have moderated over the last 6 years, and that's helpful to everyone. Everyone in the United States. It means that insurance premiums aren't going up the way they were under President Bush. It means that wages can go up. We've seen that, you know, 2 years of big increases in wages. There are lots of reasons for that. But one of the reasons that hasn't gotten a lot of attention is moderate health care costs to employers. And when you moderate health care costs, they can take some of the increases in productivity, increases in revenue, and actually, instead of putting them into health care premiums, they can put them into wage growth. And so I think everyone actually has benefited, even though we don't recognize it, from the Affordable Care Act.
And yet the Affordable Care Act is not only by Republicans been demonized to the extreme, but all those years that it was being demonized and all that campaign demonization didn't necessarily burgeon forward a plan coming from the GOP. And I'm wondering, since they've been talking largely about block grants and about tax cuts and, you know, also about steep cuts to Medicaid, these kinds of things, can they actually, I mean, this is a political question, and you've had access to actually sitting down with President Trump. I want to talk to you about that. But are there chances of some kind of bipartisan approach moving forward, do you think?
I've always thought that there are chances of bipartisan approach. That is why I went to talk to the president at his request, which is health policy experts from the left and the right actually agree on about 70% of the way to move forward. We have to change how we pay doctors and hospitals so that they focus on two things, keeping people healthy, improving the quality of care that they give, and lowering costs, being responsible for total expenditures on patients and keeping those down. And we have a lot of data that we can actually drive efficiency in the system, getting rid of unnecessary care, and improving quality for people. And I think if we focused in on the areas of agreement, we could go forward. I would also note that CNN had a debate. Some people may have seen it last night between Graham and Cassidy and Klobuchar and Bernie Sanders. And there was agreement there right on stage about drug prices.
In fact, I think you said the president was seemed very receptive and almost sensitive. I'm paraphrasing a bit here to the notion that drug prices are too high.
Right. And so I think build on the places where we have agreement and don't build on the places where we have disagreement. And I think we could actually really propel the American healthcare system forward if we built on those places where we have agreement.
On the other hand, you've got Bernie Sanders talking about single payer. You've got people talking about tax cut and, as I said, block grants and those kinds of things. There's such division and never the twain, it seems, at least on the surface.
Again, healthcare, because it's so enormous, there's a lot of stuff. And yes, it's easy to find areas of disagreement. It's also, I would argue, easy to find areas of agreement. And we can actually help the system, even if we can't comprehensively reform it, by finding those areas of agreement.
Haven't you said, though, that the number one thing is to get rid of uncertainty, that the insurance companies need to know what's going on?
In the short term, that's absolutely true, because there are two sources of uncertainty for them. One is what's going to happen, but in particular, these cost-sharing subsidies are very problematic. And then the reinsurance plan that we had in the Affordable Care Act to compensate insurance companies that might have got a disproportionate number of sick people choosing their plan in the exchanges. If you compensate, if you put two policies in place, guarantee the cost-sharing subsidies, those are subsidies for poor people to help them with the deductibles and the co-pays, and you have reinsurance so that insurance companies actually are compensated if they get too many sick people, you can actually bring down premiums for each one of those between 5 and 10%, so maybe as much as 10 to 20%. So that kind of certainty in the insurance industry has a big impact on consumers choosing health care.
Got to bring down the premiums, got to bring down the deductibles.
They're absolutely
too high. But also, you went around the country really looking for high quality and lower cost, looking for affordability and looking for ways that this is being done right. And you found what largely? I mean, what would be the kind of guideposts here?
there's all. I like to maybe I can bring people back to California wines. And I like to say, you know, you may not believe this, but the thing that gives me the most hope about healthcare is California wines. And the reason is when I was growing up as a young kid, American wines, California wines, was Gallo Jugs, and it wasn't very good.
And Thunderbird.
Right, exactly. And then in 1976, there was this, challenge in Paris about California wines versus French wines. And lo and behold, California wines won. They showed in Paris, in the heart of France.
A lot to do with a fellow named John DeLuca, by the way, who talked about the health care and then got on 60 Minutes and all this stuff with health. California really played that.
Yeah. So what they did is we actually, because the Americans are innovative, entrepreneurial, creative, and when we want to win, we really drive to be the best. We became the best in wines. And by the way, it's not just wines. Beers now, America's great. Olive oils, chocolates, cheeses, all sorts of things that we did not do well in my life when I was a kid, we're now the best. Same thing can happen in healthcare. And when you go around the country, you see that with the right incentives, there are the entrepreneurial spirit is there, the innovation is there, and we really can deliver high quality healthcare at lower cost. So just here in California, in Southern California, I went to there's a group called CareMore, and they have very sick, frail elderly. So they deal with sick, frail Medicare recipients. They're just knocking it out of the park. Their quality is super high. The number of patients admitted to the hospital is about 70% lower than the rest of California. They save money. They treat patients in the home. To patients who are sick, they have intensive services. I even note that they have a affiliated health clinic called Nifty After 50 for their patients that's tailor exercises for particular patients so that they address the problems, whether it's falling or other things for them and to keep them healthy. So this is an amazing case where you can actually provide super high quality care, not by cutting, but by actually focusing in on care in the right place, at the home, keeping people healthy and well and fit, and avoid hospitalizations. That is going to be the secret going forward over the long haul. And when you travel the country, there are small practices doing this. I visited a small oncology group of 9 doctors in Pennsylvania that was doing a great job in standardizing care, keeping their cancer patients out of the emergency room by having open access to their schedule. So if they got sick, they could just come into the office. To a group in Hawaii that had a very innovative system where they had psychologists right in the primary care doctor's office so that they could attend to behavioral health problems. So you see innovation everywhere, and, you know, if you're a person like me, you're a big optimist. Okay, what's this innovation? Let's record it, and let's get other people
You've
to adopt it.
You've always been optimistic, Zeke. didn't you say, in fact, let me give you a quote of yours, by 2020, the Affordable Care Act will increasingly be seen as world historical achievement, even more important in the United States than Medicare or Social Security has been. And there will be increasing respect for Barack Obama like Truman over time, comparable to Harry S. Truman.
Yeah. Yeah. And
stand by.
Well, I've got 3 more years on that prediction. but I think even if I've got the timing a little wrong, I do think people now recognize, certainly in the health policy community, and then I think broader, that the passage of the Affordable Care Act was an important psychological change in the health system that did force doctors and hospitals and nursing homes and home health care agencies to focus on becoming more efficient, eliminating unnecessary care, getting rid of readmissions, errors like medication errors or hospital-acquired conditions. That's a big change. Also, lots of places now are changing how they're paying doctors and hospitals, and that's an important. You got to change the incentive structure so that they really do focus on keeping people healthy. That is the future, and the Affordable Care Act was a catalyst to that. And that I think that's going to be recognized when the history is written.
Well, you've been talking about California. We have physician-assisted suicide now in California. You're still opposed to it, I believe.
You're absolutely right.
And you also wrote that article back in talking about nursing homes and the like for Atlantic a number of years ago about how we should live to 75. We've had a good life and everything. Everything, demographic numbers and everything suggests that maybe exceeding the age of 75 This doesn't sound optimistic, by the way, but exceeding the age of 75, if you called yourself.
It's realistic. It's realistic.
Let's call it realistic, but it certainly generated a lot of controversy. And in fact, I think, wasn't Sarah Palin calling you Orwellian because you said maybe we should emphasize health for the youth, maybe more than the old, got to fall off the tree and all that Richard Lamb type stuff, right? Let's get to that for a moment, if we could, to you, because, I mean, pretty much you stand by that. 75 is old enough, even though you got all these people past 75 who are vital and lively and doing just fine and have all their marbles into their 80s, even nonagenarians.
Yes. First of all, let's be clear what I stand behind so that we don't confuse your listeners, because the title of the article sort of made me seem like, you know, I just wanted to have a lot of assisted suicide going on out there, which is wrong. So what I said in the article is that I think we need to be realistic. Almost everyone I ask, I said, so do you want to live as long as possible? Or do you want to live a high quality life? Almost everyone says, I want to live a high quality life. I said, all right, let's focus in on what it means to live a high quality life. And let's look at the data about those kind of lives. We all want to live a meaningful life. We want to have meaningful work. We want to have meaningful relationships. We want to have avocational interests and fun things that we do. I like to bicycle ride. I like to hike. I like to kayak. I want to do those things. I love to cook. All of those require, you know, certainly being cognitively intact. They also often require being physically intact. And the fact is that as we grow old, our cognitive function declines. All of us, our short-term memory, our working memory declines when we get older.
What's the name of that senator from Kentucky again?
Exactly. And you're not the only. I'm not near 75 yet, and it's happening for me too. Just ask my kids. So we have some cognitive decline. And then if you look at the onset of Alzheimer's, you know, after 75, it just goes up almost vertically. It is super scary. So that by 85, at least a third of the population, and some estimates more, have Alzheimer's. So we have to be a little clear. So that's the mental side. There's also the physical side, where we all know, I mean, I'm sure you know, you get injured and it takes a long time to recover. A large number of people are actually having more and more physical ailments, as we well know. And then I think people need to be realistic. I mean, yes, we can point to people who are perfectly intact, vital at 85. They're outliers just by the data. We all are not going to be that. We don't often point to the nursing home patients or the patients who are locked into their house because they can't get out and they're not actually vitally engaged. And so my argument is, look, 75 is a rich, robust life if we try to do everything we can. And we should stop taking advanced medical treatment then. Not that we should do euthanasia or assisted suicide, but we don't need life-sustaining treatment after that.
All right, let me bring this to the listeners, because we're talking about healthcare and aging and how long one should be granted life and all that, or how long one wants to live. With Zeke Emanuel, he's Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and chairs the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at University of Pennsylvania. If you'd like to join this conversation, if you have questions or comments, you can join us now at our toll-free number. Number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program at 866-733-6786, or you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. We're spending this hour with Zeke Emanuel. He's the author of Prescription for the Future, the 12 Transformational Practices of Highly Effective Medical Organizations. And as we said, he went around the country pretty much canvassing what's working and also probably, no doubt, as his book suggests, finding out what doesn't work. I want to ask you, speaking about what's working, we just did a half-hour segment on opioids and harm reduction, and I'd like to get your take on that, because so much of the healthcare crisis really is because of the doctors and Big Pharma are both to blame here, medical practitioners for overprescribing. We got into that in the last segment. I think that's pretty much common knowledge at this point, but the problem is getting out of hand, and the cocaine is getting cheaper, but also in some ways more expensive. We talk about the powder cocaine as opposed to black tar cocaine. Just like your
heroin.
Yeah. Like your sense about, you know, how this figures into the whole healthcare crisis and what to do about it.
Well, we've had a healthcare crisis before. We had the opioid crisis, but the opioid crisis certainly exacerbates it, and exacerbates it in, I mean, one of the things that is a hallmark of this crisis, or two of the things, is very rural populations where, you know, there's a kind of hopelessness. There aren't that many jobs in these areas. People are aren't finding meaning in their life, and this it has been one exit. And also, this it turns out to be a big problem among, you know, sort of middle to older age white men, which is also a novel. And again, it, a lot of people think that this is related to a kind of hopelessness over job loss, loss of meaning. One of the big things that I point out in the book is the focus on behavioral health. Whether it's depression, anxiety, substance abuse, including alcohol, but also obviously opioid abuse, has to be a cornerstone of the healthcare system. We know that people who have chronic illness, whether it's arthritis or diabetes or heart disease, that have mental illness problems, you have to treat the mental illness. Otherwise, the other chronic conditions are much more expensive, don't get well treated, and places that have deal with a lot of old people recognize that many of them are addicted to drugs, many of them are addicted to alcohol, and we need to focus in much better and integrate behavioral health much more with a regular health. For decades, we've kept them separate. You know, the mental health institutions were away. The psychiatrists wrote separate notes that were never in the medical record. They never were co-located. We now know that co-location and working together between primary care doctor and mental health specialist doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. It can be psychologists, psychiatric social workers. Huge benefit to the healthcare system all the way around. And that has to become standardized in our country, as does, obviously, lots of other treatment. I know that in the last hour and many other people have suggested sort of decriminalization of heroin and opioids. And I'm not going to take a position on that, frankly, because I don't know enough. I haven't studied it enough. But I think the idea that this is a medical problem and it's not just a weakness of will problem and that we need to see this in a larger social perspective is very, very important.
Speaking about larger social perspectives, I do want to get our callers on here and get some comments coming in that I think we should discuss as well. Yesterday, I had Franklin Foer on as a guest, and he's, like you, part of a triumvirate of brothers, Joshua Ford and also Jonathan Safran Foer. And, of course, your brothers are well-known, Ari Emanuel and particularly Rahm Emanuel, now mayor of Chicago. I wonder if, you know, you're not your brother's keeper or anything, but murder in Chicago has become, you know, in many people's minds, and President Trump has flagellated it, so to speak. I mean, used it as a kind of a whipping thing. But it's a public health crisis, too, isn't it? And what to do about it? What to do about just those burgeoning numbers? Any thoughts that you put in your brother's ear or that you maybe want to put in my listeners' ears?
Well, look, violence, it has always been much higher in the United States. We've tolerated guns in a way that other countries don't. We have people with mental illness also a large number, and the system hasn't been great at treating them. And I think that combination has been problematic. I grew up in a family that was always for gun control. Going back to the 60s, my mom was active in many issues, civil rights, gun controls, anti-war movement. One of Chicago's problems, I think, my brother confronts is the fact that, you know, right across the border is Indiana. Guns are a lot more available there. I think it's similarly, you know, other cities on the East Coast know that, you know, guns come up. There's a sort of southern corridor up where guns are available.
We might be in danger here of starting a gun control debate.
Gun control is part and parcel of healthcare. There are a lot of issues. If you're having the healthcare system dealing with the long-term consequences of gun violence, I have to say, for me, I understand and actually appreciate people who hunt and look at that as a sort of skill. And I think, you know, all power to them. And if that's the skill they want to perfect, I think that it's in some ways even admirable. That doesn't say why you need a 20-bullet magazine to go deer hunting or quail hunting. That just doesn't make any sense to me. I think that would dramatically change certainly the large-scale violence that we see. But it is a public health problem. I mean, I don't think we can deny it in the health community that we end up addressing it. You know, when you've got tens of thousands of people being injured by and killed, we end up with the consequences. And so we need to address it. You can't just wait for the people to show up with gun wounds. You have to address it further up. And that does include mental health, being better about mental health treatment.
And we're going to go to our callers. Let me advise you that you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And we're talking with Ezekiel Emanuel, Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy, University of Pennsylvania, author of Prescription for the Future, the 12 Transformational Practices of Highly Effective Medical Organizations. Here's Joel. Joel, join us.
Hi. Thank you, and appreciate having the opportunity to ask Dr. Emanuel a question. So you talked about coming to California and looking at things that worked. I am a member of a family that multi-generational have gotten their health care from Kaiser Permanente. And I'm a big fan of Kaiser, and I just want to know what you think of Kaiser, the Kaiser model. And if you like it, why hasn't that model spread to other parts of the country?
Well, I don't want to promote the book so blatantly, but read the book, because I do talk about Kaiser. And in particular, I talk about Kaiser Mid-Atlantic around the Washington, D.C. area, Maryland and Virginia, as an interesting case. So it almost went bust. I mean, there has been this lore that Kaiser grew up in Oregon with the Grand Coulee Dam and in Northern California, and Kaiser is limited to California. Every effort to extend outside of California has been a failure, or so people say. And then you go to Kaiser Mid-Atlantic and you say, it almost was a failure in the late 2000s. It was collapsing. And then Northern California Kaiser took it over. And what happened is they instituted some of the 12 transformational practices that I recommend: standardization of care, chronic care coordination, selective contracting with hospitals that are efficient and specialists that are efficient. They had open access scheduling. They did some telepsychiatry for people in crisis. And lo and behold, it's been growing by leaps and bounds. It's one of the 13 best health plans in the country, highly five-star rating by Medicare. You can't say enough about it. And it's far, far away from Northern California and Oregon.
But you know what people say about Kaiser? They say, I mean, here in Northern California, they say it's really great. A lot of people praise it, but they say it's closer to socialized medicine than anything.
Well, I don't want to get into the socialized medicine labeling. I just want to say, you know, good things ought to be reproduced. And I think people have tried to reproduce the entire structure of Kaiser. And what I think Kaiser Mid-Atlantic said is, look, there are practices that we can take, even if the sort of local healthcare environment isn't the same. And those practices are things that can be reproduced and deliver high quality, low cost care outside of California and Oregon. And in fact, that is true. And that, again, gives me tremendous hope that we can take these practices that I have identified and move them all around the country and not just the places they, quote unquote, grew up or developed. So I agree with you. It's a very good model. Is the whole country going to become Kaiser-like? You know, that probably wouldn't be a bad thing, but I don't see it in our future.
Unlikely. And let me thank the caller. I want to go to more of your calls in just a moment. First, here's a question from Steph, who wants to know about the Alexander Murray. He wants to know the status. This is Senator Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray. He says, I've heard they're at an impasse or were blocked by McConnell. When might they have a product, you know?
So the problem is that, yes, they were overshadowed by Graham Cassidy. When the Republicans thought they could get Graham Cassidy, they put the ice on Alexander Murray negotiations, you know, to say you're at an impasse. I think this is a case of where we can have some bipartisan agreement. The last I heard about the negotiations is that they were sort of really focused just on the cost-sharing subsidies. I think we would like a larger package to stabilize the exchanges. And now, probably with the demise of Graham Cassidy, we probably will get renewed interest in this negotiation. and I think probably get a deal. I hope it's a broader deal that not only the cost-sharing subsidies, but includes reinsurance, includes some potential tax relief for insurance companies that go into bear, so-called bear counties, counties without insurance companies or with only one insurance company. I think that set of packages, along with better enforcement of the individual mandate, would go a long way towards getting people to buy insurance and stabilize the exchanges and bring premiums down.
Well, here's a breaking news story. Senate Republicans apparently are discussing whether to use their next budget reconciliation measure to target the Affordable Care Act.
Someone suggested that to sort of keep this alive for a year. The reason that seems unlikely is that they want to use the Reconciliation Act for their tax proposal, and you can't do both. You can do one. It'll be interesting to see how they choose. I would have thought, again, this is sort of, I'm not the political brother, that's my brother Rahm, but just standing with a little knowledge, healthcare has not been a winner for the Republicans, and I would have thought that they would like to sort of not keep it on the front burner for another year going into the 2018 elections, that getting something on the tax system, or at least increasing the odds they'll get something on the tax system, is probably a better bet for them. So I would downplay that. That may be a way of sort of trying to scare people into endorsing the Graham Cassidy bill.
Well, let me endorse some more calls here because we got a lot of them. Let's get Joan on next. Joan, you're on. Morning.
Hi. What would you say to a plan which kept Medicaid and then for the middle class, the federal government paid for catastrophic insurance? The federal government paid out of pocket. You don't have to worry about pre-existing conditions or pools or whatever. But if a person spent more than, say, 15% of their income in any year, they would fall under the federal plan of pay for catastrophic insurance.
Well, it sounds good. The problem is if you dig down into how healthcare is spent and where the costs are, it's probably not the best system to go by for several reasons. First, this catastrophic-only coverage means that people are unlikely to get preventative services. We know that if you put any financial barrier between people and preventative services, they tend to not get that mammogram or the colonoscopy or the pap smear or what have you.
But boy, do we need more preventive medicine.
And we need more preventive medicine. Thank you. Second, it turns out, if you, again, look at the data, 10% of the population consumes 2/3 of the healthcare dollars. They are going to get past your whatever your limit is. And that, I think, means that you're not going to save that much money by that plan. And the federal government's going to be covering a lot of bills. You're in my experience where we might have a $1,000 or $2,000 of healthcare in the year is not typical. Is typical for us, but we're not typical of the people who are actually heavy users of the healthcare system. So the 10% of people who are heavy users of the healthcare system are going to be subsidized here, and it's not going to save that much money. So I did look at this plan, actually. My brother asked me to look at a plan not too dissimilar from what you've just suggested when I was in the White House, and it actually doesn't save. It's not that cost effective or cost efficient. And the last thing I would say is people hate their deductibles. If you're basically going to put on a 15% of income deductible on them, I don't think you're going to win a lot of popularity contests.
Let me thank the caller. Didn't you find, though, in your sort of Johnny Appleseed journey across finding out what healthcare works, that healthcare delivery in the United States is utterly inconsistent?
Oh, yeah. And we've known that for a long time. I mean, not quite 10 years ago, the Institute of Medicine produced a report showing that there's probably over $200 billion in unnecessary care delivered to people. There's about $130, $40 billion in inefficiently delivered care. Prices are all out of whack. You can go from New York and get a colonoscopy at $8,000 down to Baltimore and get it for $1,800. The delivery system needs to be fixed. And as I say in the book, the important thing that we can do is to change the incentives for the delivery system. Don't pay doctors to do things, and don't pay doctors only when they do things. You need to pay doctors to keep people healthy, and you need to pay doctors to actually be prudent with how they're spending the money so that they have an incentive to be efficient. They have an incentive when there are options. I mean, I'm a cancer doctor, I think, as you mentioned at the start. You know, there are many, many different chemotherapies for diseases, and some of them are more expensive than others because they use brand name drugs or others, and yet they have the same clinical outcome. We should incentivize doctors to choose the cheaper treatments when the clinical outcomes are the same. I'll give you a good example. Radiation oncologists, for women who have a lumpectomy to remove a breast cancer, then they get radiation therapy. We know that 7 weeks of radiation therapy is equivalent to 3 weeks of radiation therapy at a slightly higher dose, what's called hypofractionation. Exactly the same in terms of cosmetic results, recurrence rate, and even long-term survival. We have 4 randomized trials to this effect, and yet most American women get 7 weeks of treatment instead of 3 weeks of treatment, even though 3 weeks of treatment is about two-thirds the cost. That's a clear case of where we're being inefficient. We're giving people much more treatment than they need. It's not good for the patient to keep coming back and forth, and it's more expensive, and there's no better result. So that's a kind of situation where we need to shift the incentives to incentivize the radiation oncologist to give 3 weeks of more intensive treatment.
Well, then you get into this whole question of cost. So I remember when I was kind of prompted to get a colonoscopy, and they said, this is Kaiser. I said, oh, maybe you want a sigmoidoscopy, you know. And I talked to some doc friends of mine, and they said, no, go for the colonoscopy because it's much more thorough and it's much more reliable. But sigmoidoscopies are a lot cheaper. So, you know, those lines are drawn in so many different fashions, it seems. In fact, I've got a question here that sort of dovetails with all this. Michael writes, Americans pay far more for health care per person than any other country with similar life expectancy. Until basic costs are addressed, it is unrealistic to expect real solutions to the fiasco of American health care. So you have suggestions about reducing costs other than the kind of example that I used, where you're getting not necessarily the same efficacy?
What you suggested is exactly what we don't want to do.
Exactly.
Which is you give lesser medicine to save money. What you want to do is to look at, is to do three things, it seems to me. The first is there are services which are totally unnecessary, and we have to eliminate that. And those are worth hundreds of billions of dollars a year. That is, you know, again, I'm a breast cancer doctor. I think of everything in terms of cancer. There's a study in Seattle that showed for women with early stage breast cancer, very small nodules, in some places, 8 out of 10 were getting this test called a PET CT to look for tumors in other places. No professional society recommends it, all recommend against it, including the radiologists. And yet 80% of women in some practices were getting this test. Totally unnecessary care. That test costs about $5,000 or $6,000, depending upon where it's done. We got to get rid of that. We got to say to doctors, we're not paying for that stuff. You cannot be incentivized to do that and make money doing that. Second, we have to get them to be more efficient. I gave you an example of radiation oncology, but, you know, the operating room is a very expensive place in a hospital. There's a lot of inefficiencies there. We need to be more efficient about that. I'll give you one example from my personal experience, again, as an oncologist. Is I used to do bone marrow biopsies. That's take out the bone marrow to look for leukemic patients. Has the leukemia come back? And then I used to clean up the room. Well, you don't have the doctor clean up the room. That's not efficiency. Simple
things
like
that. You mean with a broom and all that?
Simple things like that make a big difference in healthcare when done systematically. And we need to incentivize the system to do that, not to substitute less effective treatments in America, but to actually have high quality care at lower cost. We can do it. We know how to do it. We need to incentivize the system to actually put those practices in place.
And as I might have predicted, you're getting some pushback on 75. You want to hear an example?
Here's a surprise.
Listen, so 75 is young. I manage volunteers at a park where many of the 80-somethings are vibrant, active, many because of life-sustaining medical innovations. Just this morning, I'm headed to a health and wellness fair at a local residence for elders. Please don't put a number on old. I was reminded of one of my favorite quips of Mark Twain's, you know, age is mind over matter. You don't mind, it doesn't matter, but it may be true up to a point. But, you know, there is a lot of vibrant people into there, as we've pointed out. But the numbers is really what you were crunching there. The numbers are sobering, disheartening.
Look.
You're an optimist, though.
I'm an optimist. There are going to be some people who are vibrant, mentally as well as physically, into their 80s. I don't deny it. And if they say, look, I want to continue, I want life-saving treatment, I think we need to be realistic and not point to the isolated cases, but point to people generally as they are. One of the things this caller doesn't see is doesn't go to the actual nursing home and see people who are not engaged, not vibrant, and are, frankly, you know, you have to ask yourself, is that their is that a meaningful life? Is that the kind of life we live? I'm not judging their life. My essay was very personal, and it was a challenge to people. Think about what makes your life meaningful. Think about what is going to be worth it to you, and don't be afraid to confront that head on, because most of us go through life not thinking about the bigger picture, not thinking about, well, is this a meaningful contribution? Am I really doing what I want?
And a tough question for many people who get up, for example, septuagenarian and all that sort of thing is, you know, if you have some kind of condition, do you, for example, I have diabetes. I say to myself, as long as we're talking personal for a moment, and I'll say to myself, I can avoid these carbs. I can avoid these sugars, white rice, whatever, and probably be healthier. But how much time do I have left, really, you know? And it's a serious and a very vexing question in many respects because, you know, you want to eat the things that you enjoy. Anyway,
I think Leonard Cohen once said that when he turned 80, he started smoking again because he really liked it. And he didn't have that much time left to go anyway.
Here's a caller right on point. Tia, join us. You're on the air.
Hi there.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hello. Yeah. Hi, it's T. Yeah. Yeah, so I was just going to talk about what I work as a nurse here in the Bay Area, and he was talking about the age of 75, and I see patients. I work as a cardiovascular, neurovascular nurse, and I see patients getting procedures and stuff that they do not need at an elderly age, and it just causes more complications. Just like your guest is saying, there are outliers of people who are over the age of 75 that are doing great, but the majority of people that I take care of have gotten one surgery to deal with one problem that's had two or three different complications. It just made their life and their quality of life more complicated. After reading Being Mortal by Atwal Gawande, I understood that, like, people need to understand what quality of life is. As healthcare providers, we do a bad job of talking to them about that. We just say, well, this treatment will make you a lot better, as opposed to having these conversations, or what do you want to do at this age and what can we do to get you there, as opposed to doing this treatment or that surgery or these medications that have certain complications and they'll make their life better.
Well, thank you for those remarks.
I want to emphasize, I think those are exactly the right remarks, which is we can't point to the isolated individual or our aunt or our grandmother and say this is the norm. We need to look at what the norm is. But I want to endorse what you say, and I certainly lived it as a cancer doctor all the time, which is instead of talking about the big picture, what is your goal in life? What is going to make your life meaningful? We end up focusing in on the procedure, or in my case, it was typically the blood count or which chemotherapy I could get. And it seems to me, as doctors and healthcare providers who are often much more comfortable talking about the procedure rather than talking about the big picture of the meaning of life, and yet really medicine is a means to realizing your patient's meaning in life. And that's the big picture. And then we should ask, well, once we understand what you want in life, how do these procedures and tests work into it? Because if there's a high risk that, you know, it's going to lead to complications, as you point out, or going to mean that, you know, you can't do many things for 6, 8, 10 months, is that worth it to you? And I think we in the medical profession and nursing profession, as you point out, tend not to have those conversations. But that's precisely what my article was trying to do, is to provoke people into, let's think about that. Let's discuss it together as a family or as a husband and wife pair or as a patient and doctor.
But you've got all these costs, too, that are attendant to people who are in, you know, essentially so many of them being warehoused. They're in, you know, constant care, requiring constant care. It drains families' fortunes and so forth. Why are you against physician-assisted suicide? I just have a close friend, for example, who made that decision because, as I said, it's legal in California. She had, in fact, serious lung cancer. And she was suffering, and, you know, it was her decision, and it was done in a very, I thought, orderly and well-orchestrated way.
Have you reserved the next hour to discuss this? Because this is not a short subject. So
why your opposition? I just can't get to the heart.
Let me give you three quick reasons. The first one is a lot of people think, oh, we legalize euthanasia and assisted suicide, and we've solved the end-of-life care problem. Far from it. Even in Oregon, where it's been on the books now for more than a decade, less than 1% of the population uses it. That means 99% of dying patients are not using assisted suicide and euthanasia. You're not solving the end-of-life care problem, and you're diverting attention from actually addressing the end-of-life care problem. Second, almost all the evidence, I started this evidence in the mid-1990s. We showed the we were the first people to show this. You know, the main reason people want assisted suicide euthanasia is not what your listeners think. Oh, extreme pain. That's not why people want assisted suicide and euthanasia. They want it because
they don't want their family to carry the burden economically.
No, it's not burden either. It's loss of autonomy. It's worrying about not being in control.
Yeah.
Now, I'm all for people being in control, but the solution to feeling like you've lost control is not to off yourself with a doctor's help. That it's mostly mental health, depression, psychological distress, and that needs to be dealt with, not by giving people suicide
pills. Have you read your Camus? It's a basic philosophical question that anybody can answer, right?
I have read my Camus, and I'm against assisted suicide. And I would say that last thing is assisted suicide tends to be used by the rich and well off. And we think that once we've solved it for ourselves, we don't have to take care of other people. And I think that's actually not I would like us to keep our eye on the ball. We want high-quality end-of-life care for everyone. And assisted suicide and euthanasia, I think, is largely a diversion by the rich and well-off who control everything else in their life rather than address this problem head-on and much more systematically.
That brings us to the end of a very informative hour, which I thank you for, and congratulations on your book. And we spent the hour with Ezekiel Emanuel. Let me plug his book one more time. You going to be appearing anywhere in town?
Or? I'm at the Commonwealth Club.
Oh, it's sold out at the Commonwealth Club, naturally.
But, sorry about that.
You'll have to come back. We enjoy having you. The book is Prescription for the Future, The 12 Transformational Practices of Highly Effective Medical Organizations. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And I appreciate your listenership today and every day that you are with us from 9 to 11, Monday through Friday. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.